Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 87, section 7, which is old single column page 965. All right. Let's see here. What do we want to say in advance? I guess recall that, you know, this is the final section here of this paper, and they've given us, their initial pass through the complexifying concept of the ghost cult, and they want to make this final epilogue statement about the fact of a cult in general. And I'll hold off some of my general remarks and spread them out over the first two paragraphs here as we read them, including the wording of the title of the section. I think I mentioned at the end of the session last time that it's very important for them to make a statement like they do in this section, to highlight the contrast between what each of us can take on as individuals in that parallel stream of courageous and independent individuals on the planet, in contrast to the main evolutionary stream. And it's the fact that it's almost totally limited to the evolutionary process. I mean, very little can happen in the main evolutionary stream except, the very, very glacial process. You know, there's flashes of significant individuals that flail the evolutionary stream around some occasionally, but it settles back down, okay, and just plods along when you average through the short-term fluctuations. You know, and because that externalized social phenomenon doesn't have an inner life of its own. Right? The only inner lives are in the inner life. It's not in that outer life of the social context. So it's only in our inner life. You know, and I remember the purely inner life, the upper domain in the hourglass analogy, that you can use your free will to turn something on a dime, advance something very rapidly. Otherwise, it plods along. And so the concept of cults is very important to the main evolutionary stream. So at the same time that we, in many ways, like I emphasized so much as we went through this paper, how you as an individual can just get the big eraser out and say, okay, that's it, I'm done with the ghost cult. I'm not going to be satisfied anymore with a God concept that's limited to the ghost cult frame. I want to go in search of the real God. I want to have a genuinely personal spiritual experience. I want to discover genuine religion, real religion, true religion, which is a purely individual fact. See, so, the fact that this is not a dispensational revelation. And as a non-dispensational revelation, it invariably has something for the main evolutionary stream, but then kind of the deeper, more profound something for that parallel stream of rugged individuals. What that does is remind you that eventually you don't have two streams. You start out, the only stream you have is the main evolutionary stream, and there really is no parallel stream. But eventually, when you get to light and life, there is, you know, less and less is there a main evolutionary stream, quote unquote, in that parallel stream of rugged individuals. It's all, that's the whole planet, is a vast stream of courageous and independent cosmic thinkers. Yeah. So it evolves across the divide between those two streams over time. And anywhere in between, you always have the opportunity to, as an individual, to pull yourself out a little bit, you know, and to discover the joy of liberty in your inner life, you know, even if literally in the outer life you're in chains. Yeah. But at the very least, you're in some form of cultural, intellectual, whatnot bondage, right, to the plotting, you know, never as idealistic as you desire, you know, bulk of humanity.
Yeah, and what you said is really, you know, we have to remember, I think, that we're on a rebellious, you know, planet, and so the way it would normally go, you know, follow out in most places, they would have been sort of brought along that way from the beginning, mm-hmm. and it would be much more in touch with a normal procedure for that growth to happen. Mm-hmm. And as we are today, it's you know, it's a little bit different. Not only, you know, we've added to our experiment.
Yeah, I mean,
it's going to be creative.
I mean, one of the main reasons why, when they tell you on a normal world post-Bastille Sun, the nature of civilization is so different than what you have here, it's literally not imaginable to you. I mean, the main reason for that is that's the primary job of the Bastille Sun, is to really develop that off-ramp of that, you know, original evolutionary stream and begin to get people transitioning over into that eventual single stream of courageous and independent individuals, right? He's there as the spiritual uplifter, you know, to definitively begin to get the absolute uniqueness of personalities, you know, in play. So, but that, of course, you know, Michael, our creator son, couldn't do that as a Bastille son. It's just, you know, but he could at least try to get people to consider the possibility that there's an inner life. You know, if he had some thoughts that he was going to have some significant success in really getting people to take an off-ramp, that was quickly dispelled. You know, the more he tried to push forward in his public ministry, the more obvious it was that, no, that's not going to happen. Right? There's this vast conspiracy, right, called the evolution of the Supreme that is, you know, is just not in the proper state for that to happen here yet. Right? So, you know, he had to just, you know, let go of most of his thoughts, you know, of really getting a significant civilizational transition going, and try to just, you know, give people to at least pause and consider the possibility that there might be something besides a material, a socialized material life and your feelings about it. You know, and especially, you know, that the something more isn't an illusory extrapolation of that, like we've been reading about, you know, predicated on the dream life. So, anyway, let's see what enough said up front. Let's see what they tell us here in these first couple paragraphs, and I'll expand a little bit more.
7. Nature of cultism. The cult type of social organization persisted because it provided a symbolism for the preservation and stimulation of moral sentiments and religious loyalties. The cult grew out of the traditions of old families and was perpetuated as an established institution. All families have a cult of some sort. Every inspiring ideal grasps for some perpetuating symbolism, seeks some technique for cultural manifestation which will ensure survival and augment realization. And the cult achieves this end by fostering and gratifying emotion.
Okay. So, why don't I highlight the little specific points first, and then I'll get to the general issue. When you say every inspiring ideal grasps for some perpetuating symbolism, okay, they can tell you that, and you can just believe it arbitrarily, but you could ask yourself why. Try to recognize what the deal is there. Obviously, genuine ideals, which are spiritual, not material, are very abstract. And even if you have, by grace, some tentative touch upon such a remote, abstract fact for us as material creatures, you can't hold on to that, for any length of time. That perpetuation, perpetuating. You're going to have to produce some sort of externalized symbolism so that you can kind of, so that you have an external reminder, a touchstone to kind of keep you from not just totally slipping down away from ideals to just ideas. Okay, so that's, and that symbolism doesn't have to be literally a symbol, a graphic symbol, right? It could be a particular specific mode of ritual or whatever. I mean, just something external that is fixed and is a touchstone, and it's it has some sense of mystery to it, so that it reminds you, there's that higher sense that I'm trying to stay in touch with. Okay, and a lot of times in the ritual, the very fact that whatever the people are doing has no practicality to it. It's just strangely mysterious. Like, well, why are they moving their bodies like that? And you can't, they're not trying to pick grain. They're not trying to wash the floor. There's no apparent practical reason to move your body that way. That's the little clue, the little reminder that this is a symbol for something that's not tangible. Okay, and humans just need to do that because it's so remote. As we've talked about endless times, all of these basically spiritual words, you can't even remotely look up in the dictionary, a proper definition for them, okay, because it's just too abstract. Notice at the very end. See, this is, we often point this out. I mean, like the revelators say, it's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. Yes, but when you're talking about the main evolutionary stream, there just isn't any other mode to get things going and keep things going for a long time than emotion. And again, just notice that it's not fostering and gratifying feeling, but emotion, right? The E prefix there, which is short for EX, out, an externalized motion. And again, like I said, something, that manifests in the outer life, that makes it something that you can wrap your mind around, right, and hold on to. because it's, I mean, it's externalized. So, yeah, even though this has all kinds of problems, as we've talked about so many times, of turning yourself inside out and, you know, ending up with material idealism and all these sorts of things, you know, fixation on ritual and all this, but there just isn't any other way to begin with than to have a measure of falsely externalizing this stuff just so that humans can be holding on to something. If nothing else, you know, what they're holding on to consciously is all false, but it prevents the corruption of the superconscious facts that were put there by grace, right? The genuine faith that's there superconsciously, the genuine religion that's there superconsciously. You sort of keep a hold of the shadows, and the substance remains, you know, relatively undisturbed, and things kind of keep going where we progress in spite of ourselves. All right, now the more general issue about cults. Okay, so you know, remember that when we've talked about civilization, that you've got three terms that you can think of as in sequence, in ascending sequence. There's just merely the foundational fact of society, which is predicated on your social urge, your fifth adjutant. And then if you bring in a manifestation, the fruits of the functioning of the sixth adjutant more definitively, it's not just merely a society, then it's a culture. And so that root there, cult, right, of culture. And then remember, when you bring in the seventh and the Holy Spirit and everything, you know, you have civilization. Okay, but it's that culture part that we're wanting to focus on here. And think about how diverse this is. I mean, it all starts with cultivate. Okay? I don't know if you've ever thought, it's like, why is the word that we use for like some weird group of people, you know, that have isolated themselves somewhere doing woo-woo stuff, we call them a cult, and it's the same thing, the farmer that goes out in the field, we say he's cultivating the field. Why are these words, you know, why are these the same words? You know, so you have that basic tilling of the soil, cultivation, and you've just, you know, transferred that, you know, metaphorically to the issue of society. You're going to cultivate society into a culture. Yeah. Society is going to grow, right? And, you know, see, be more vibrant, more living. Okay, so see, it's been, you know, transferred over like that. So you've got you have the word culture. If you're, yeah, just kind of speaking in that society, culture, civilization, general mode. But if you want to focus on, you know, more of that core, quote unquote, religious element of that culture, you know, the more directly on individuals activated by the sixth adjutant, you know, then, you know, you can just speak about the cult of that society. Okay. Instead of saying the more generalized, abstract culture. And then we got one other issue. The title of the section is not Nature of Cults. It's Nature of Cultism. We want to read the next paragraph before I lay that out for you. But anyway, you see, you notice you've got, you know, as they're saying, this all starts, as one would suspect in an evolutionary way, starts with families, you know, and ongoing families animated by the sixth adjutant have a cult to them, right? They have a certain cultivated modality to them, and that eventually, you know, after a long time, and it's, you know, that's some sort of a leading family, you know, it eventually gets institutionalized. And like they're saying, and goes on. It's extremely important, as they're saying there in that first sentence, to have something like this happen. Because if it's just the fifth adjutant, it's too easy for the vicissitudes of existence to jostle people about, and some things that the society shouldn't let go of end up getting let go of, slipping through your fingers as you're jostled about by the vicissitudes of life. So you need something in the individuals that is wanting to existentialize. You need that religious impulse, that sixth adjutant, to come into play, like they're saying, so you have this for the preservation and stimulation of moral sentiments and religious loyalties. I mean, setting aside all of the limitations of what some primitive society thinks of as moral sentiments, right? I mean, the very fact that they're sentiments even, right? You know, and quote-unquote religious loyalties, okay. I mean, the limited nature of those is not, you know, initially significant. But there has to be, you know, that core nucleus, and it has to be, to a degree, thought of as existential and eternal, right? And held on to no matter what. Or there's just, the society will unravel. Right? I mean, a mere fifth adjutant society can't withstand difficulties. You need that nucleus for everyone to hold on to get you through the tough times. Okay. So that's so the cult is very important. All right, let's read that next paragraph.
From the dawn of civilization, every appealing movement in social culture or religious advancement has developed a ritual, a symbolic ceremonial. The more this ritual has been an unconscious growth, the stronger it has gripped its devotees. The cult preserves sentiment and satisfied emotion, but it has always been the greatest obstacle to social reconstruction and spiritual progress.
Okay. So see that last element. All good things taken to extreme become bad. Okay. And so there's obviously a point where this existentialization that I was saying that is helpful becomes a problem. Because things can't change when they need to. Yeah, so but it has always been the greatest obstacle to social reconstruction and spiritual progress. You know, when you bring in that kind of that sort of thinking, where it's okay, this is it. We've got the framework. You exist in this framework forevermore. You know that's the ism issue coming into play. See, and it isn't it kind of interesting to think about? Like I was pointing out, I mean, the very fact of cult or culture is coming from the sixth adjutant. You know, and you always get isms with the sixth adjutant. So it's practically inescapable that cult is cultism. Okay, it's almost redundant. Yeah. But nonetheless, that despite what they're saying there, that negative aspect, there has to be some degree of cultism. Societies have to take this very seriously. Like I said, I mean, if you don't have some sense of finality about this, you're not gonna hold on to the things that you should hold on to, quote unquote, religiously enough. Right? So, I mean, that's one of the things I try to point out as we continue to read through this, that the main evolutionary stream for a very, very long time, you know, needs cults as a complete lifestyle solution. It's kind of what holds things together. And, you know, for those who are interested in ministering to the main evolutionary stream, you have to keep that in mind, as they're going to point out. It's very different than what you can identify with and should identify with when you separate yourself from the main evolutionary stream. You don't need a cult, per se. Yeah. But the main evolutionary stream, you know, that is its complete lifestyle solution. It just is what it is. You know, there has to be that kind of an ism for the main evolutionary stream. Okay, let's see. Just one of the little technical thing. Like I was saying, I mean, the symbolism. Notice we're even using ism with symbolism, right? But it doesn't have to be a swastika, but that might be a handy thing, right? In the culture developing, right? Some literal graphic object like that. Okay, you know, before it was a Nazi symbol, it was a symbol in India, right? There's something powerful about that symbol, whether it's clockwise or counterclockwise, right? Right, but. And of course, the cross in Christianity, right? The bumper sticker, right, with all the graphic symbols, right? But you know, that's just part of it. I mean, you know, this is why it didn't just say perpetuating symbol there in that first paragraph. It said perpetuating symbolism, right? This has to be a complete lifestyle solution. A mere little image for a bumper sticker is not the complete lifestyle solution. There has to be a full, elaborate ritual system and everything. I mean, all of that is symbol. So, like they're saying there, develop a ritual, a symbolic ceremonial. All right, let's keep going here.
Notwithstanding that the cult has always retarded social progress, it is regrettable that so many modern believers in moral standards and spiritual ideals have no adequate symbolism, no cult of mutual support, nothing to belong to. But a religious cult cannot be manufactured, it must grow. And those of no two groups will be identical unless their rituals are arbitrarily standardized by authority.
Okay. I mean, just when you read that sentence, right, if you know the state of affairs in post-World War I Germany, right, anyone who is thinking, you're going, I know what these people need to get them moving again, right? Exactly what's being talked about here. Okay? You know, and it even says it is regrettable that so many modern believers, you know, remember when this is being written, and Germany is in that state, pre-Nazi state. You know, so many modern believers in moral standards and spiritual ideals have no adequate symbolism. It's like, so someone got an idea, I need to develop an adequate symbolism, right? We need a cult of mutual support. We need something to belong to, and we'll be a people again. Right, and just look what happened. You gave them that cult, you know, and they just about took over the world. Yeah, that's how powerful cults are. Cult doesn't have to be, predicated on some God notion. Right? It just needs to be, like they're saying, this very definitive, symbolic, ritualistic phenomenon that people can join. Right? and you do your sacred orders and what have you. It's extremely powerful stuff. Leaders of every ilk have always known that. You know, and even if someone doesn't have malicious desires, you know, or even purely selfish desires, it doesn't change the fact that if you're going to lead a people, there has to be, you know, some definitive, tangible things, straightforward, definitive, tangible things for people to latch onto, or you're not going to lead anyone anywhere. It's very important to think about how essential this is to the main evolutionary stream, this whole phenomenon of cults, for good or for ill. All right, let's keep going.
The early Christian cult was the most effective, appealing, and enduring of any ritual ever conceived or devised. But much of its value has been destroyed in a scientific age by the destruction of so many of its original underlying tenets. The Christian cult has been devitalized by the loss of many fundamental ideas.
Okay, so interesting contrast in that little short paragraph. I mean, first giving you that very definitive statement that initial cult that was developed, predicated on, all the various false ways that the apostles and whatnot interpreted what Jesus did and said, you know, stuck in the old ghost cult wineskin and everything. But nonetheless, you know, that cult was the most effective, appealing, and enduring of any ritual ever conceived or devised. That's a pretty definitive statement. But all it took is the Enlightenment, right, to blow it up. Because it's not based upon reality, as I was just saying. You know, it wasn't even based on the reality of what Jesus said and did. It was the way people, you know, interpreted in their old wineskins what he said and did. You know, so it's predicated on superstition and whatnot. But, you know, until those annoying Enlightenment, you know, and budding scientists came along, right, and messed it all up, it was wonderful for you know, moving mankind forward based upon illusions. Yeah. And so now what? Now that Western civilization doesn't have that cult, right, the main evolutionary stream of Western civilization, what cult is going to replace it? You know, and again, you know, you don't have to join that cult, right? You can just be part of that parallel stream. But, you know, in general, all those people that aren't courageous and independent cosmic thinkers, as they italicized there, they need something to belong to. Right? Independent thinker doesn't need something to belong to. But in general, everyone else needs something to belong to.
But you're not an island universe. You still need to belong to something.
Yeah, sure. I'm not, you know, and that's why we have the in the world but not of the world's, you know,
yeah,
statement.
So you're right. Still part, like, right. I hang on to the Urantia movement, so to speak.
Yeah,
because I
want to
belong to it.
Sure. I mean, we all need to, you know, be part of a social, you know, system. Again, that parallel of an evolutionary stream doesn't divorce itself from the social system any more than Jesus and his, even in his kind of really aggressive public ministry modes at times, you know, is not a revolutionary against the social system. Okay. Yeah. So, right, but to have an inner life that's established apart from the main evolutionary stream, a genuine inner life that is original to you, not something that you've brought in from the environment and lifted up in there. He has a bunch of religious dogma and mores and stuff.
It's almost like you're responsible to stand apart also. Like, you kind of have to do that. You can't really avoid it, in my view.
Yeah. I mean, there's just no escaping. If you have an original inner life, remember, an inner life automatically manifests fruits. And your fruits, at best, will be found to be peculiar and odd, right? And don't really understand, Terry. I don't, you know. And so, right, you just aren't as part of the crowd anymore, right? I mean, Jesus, you know, his fruits were so oddball that, you know, everyone thought he was beside himself. Okay? And so, you know, just inescapably, you know, you're not part of the old crowd anymore when you start to develop that inner life. Now, again, this, like I said, I mean, eventually we discover a whole new mode of society that manifests collectively out from all of these courageous and independent thinkers, but we don't know anything about such a society. We can't, you know, they tell you point blank, like I said, we can't even imagine such a society. There's so little inner life on this planet. We've never experienced a society that really is the fruits of the Spirit. Okay? Eventually there is a very transcendent society that you belong to, and everyone's courageous and independent cosmic thinkers at the same time. Okay, but, you know, we're a long ways from that. Okay, so right now, you know, if you begin to establish something very definitive in an inner life, there isn't this future transcendent society to belong to, and you've got to kind of stand ruggedly, you know, on your own. I mean, you know, did Amadon have to stand pretty ruggedly? Yeah. You know, what of Amadon? Does he still draft off of his fellows? No, that's not what the sentence is. Right, you got to stand there, even if no one else is standing with you. You belong to nothing. That's just kind of the difficulty. Jesus was having a hard time, you know, even keeping 12 apostles on the same page with him when he started to really get definitive about it. You know, he was practically a man by himself in the world. Well, you know, there wasn't anything he could belong to. They kicked him out of every club, right, eventually.
Oh. Right, I mean, succumbed to that because they had no one who belonged with them.
Mm-hmm.
They were isolated and alone.
I mean, you know, even his, you know, he didn't even have his family. You know, he had Ruth. Okay, but you know,
he wasn't around every day.
You know, so yeah, it's just, you know, he had to just, you know, stand on his own to a great degree. That's just the way it is, you know. In this now, for you to really establish a significant inner life, you know, and inescapably start to manifest the fruits of that, everyone will look askance at you. When you do, they'll all move away from you. All right. Let's see. Anything else there? One little thing to notice. I haven't stressed this. That other bit about the sixth adjutant, and you know, sometimes I sort of kind of metaphorically say, you know, the animation that the sixth adjutant, you know, gives to your mind, you know, or the, you know, you notice how they're speaking of it as a vitalization. And when you don't have Yeah. When the sixth adjutant can't play off of the figments anymore because science has blown them up, you lose that vitalization from the sixth adjutant. See, so the Christian cult has been devitalized by the loss of many fundamental ideas. Like I said, it's just that a culture is innately more dynamic than a mere society because of that vitalization, that greater energization that the sixth adjutant brings into play, and the fruits of that inescapably manifest out into the group. Okay. Okay. Oh, wait, you got something?
Well, there's no going back, though.
No, you got to go forward. Can't go back. Although we're trying mightily. Remember, that's the interregnum. We might go back in that sense, you know. People are there's a lot of people trying mightily to shove the concept of facts that the Enlightenment brought into play aside and get back to illusions. Ellen, there's more and more leader-like individuals that are openly stating that. You have to stop fixating on this fact stuff. You know, it's whether or not it's morally right. Yeah. Okay, you know, more and more, people are discovering the old school energization with the sixth adjutant, because it's been kind of. The sixth adjutant has been kind of pouty faced for a long time, ever since the Enlightenment blew up the illusions.
Now it's been let out of the box.
Yeah, right. It's like, it's hungry to get going again, get into the game again. And it will find, a new cult, right, to generate. And it can be based upon something that is utterly devoid of any practical, factual foundation. It just doesn't matter.
That's why our church cannot get involved in politics. Because that's where the energy is.
Right. The cults aren't coming out of the churches anymore. The cults are coming out of politics and economics and, socialism and whatnot. Let's keep going here.
In the past, truth has grown rapidly and expanded freely when the cult has been elastic, the symbolism expansile. Abundant truth and an adjustable cult have favored rapidity
mm-hmm.
of social progression. A meaningless cult vitiates religion when it attempts to supplant philosophy and to enslave reason. A genuine cult grows.
Okay, so now here's where they're reminding us again of the difficulties here. Like I said up front, you need some degree of false existentialization of things so that people have something that's not changeable to believe in, right? Something to hold on to. But they're pointing out, if you're going to have living truth in play, the cult has to be elastic. The symbolism expansile. It's like, okay, well, this is kind of a catch-22 situation here, right? It's obviously going to take some degree of transcendence of merely the cult for that cult below to be morphable. See, so there has to be some degree of a higher level of a philosophic vantage point above the cult itself for the cult to be in this mode, like they're saying. Okay, in general, that philosophic, upper state. You know, that can be mostly unconscious. That, you know, that's fine. Okay, but there has to be kind of just something there that to some degree, people stand a little bit above and apart, right, from just getting totally locked into the false existentialization that the cult in and of itself wants to generate, you know, and the raw ismness of it, okay, wants to generate. You got something to throw in?
I do. Yeah? So what an example of that is something like the family here on earth, but also the family of God, which has a greater connotation and more, you know, deep, everlasting side to it, you know, which is contrasted, not really contrasted, but augments the whole family here on earth. Is that sort of an example of what you were saying in a way?
Right. One of the ways that...
Reaching of something.
Some sort of a philosophic frame up there, doesn't have to be too sophisticated, will allow for a solid concept of a spiritual brotherhood, a genuine spiritual brotherhood. You know, not just the words, okay? But if you from the top down see yourselves as fundamentally a spiritual brotherhood, then below that, the social order is more potentially changeable. If you aren't falsely exalting all those lower temporal social things up into the spiritual and the eternal, right, it allows them to change. Okay? So, you know, you can see, obviously, Jesus was trying to get at least that one little element. You know, but he was, you know, had very limited success. I mean, every time he said spiritual, everyone heard material. It was just kind of hopeless. But he was trying to get them to hold on to something changeless above so that stuff could change. You know, because like he's seeing how his people are so stuck in ruts, you know, because they've existentialized, you know, trivialities of social construct and stuff, you know, and treat them like they're of eternity.
It's the kingdom situation, even one way or another. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If there isn't some genuineness to the philosophic oversight, if you will, there can't be any genuineness to it being quote unquote spiritual, literally spiritual. You'll be using that word, but there's not going to be any real validity. It's just going to be some false exaltation of some temporal issue that you call spiritual. It won't be genuinely an eternal consciousness there. That's what the get at, see, in the latter part of that paragraph. It says, a meaningless cult vitiates, you know, in other words, it corrupts or even perverts, like vice. It vitiates religion when it attempts to supplant philosophy. Right? To put philosophy down under its foot. Okay? Philosophy has to be above. Right? And if the cult presumes to shove it down into the dirt, okay, so there isn't that vantage point above. See, that's a problem. And of course, if you don't have the philosophic oversight, genuine philosophic oversight, you're going to, you know, this cult is going to poke its nose into the scientific domain, and then it's going to enslave reason. Okay. The only way that you can keep science and religion true and apart, one's about matter, one's about spirit, and one's about time, one's about eternity, now, is if you have something above, right? So that you can look down, oh, wait a minute, time and eternity are blurring together. I mean, if you're down in the midst of that, you don't have the oversight to keep them separated. And see, and obviously it's a, like I said, it's going to be a meaningless cult that supplants like this. Because if you don't have some genuineness of a philosophic oversight, there's no real place for spirit to be, or it's a property, value. If there's no value, there's no meaning. So it's a meaningless cult. Okay. So that's the but obviously the moment that you spin up the sixth adjutant, you're playing with fire. It's going to want to do this. And the sixth adjutant in and of itself is very aggressive, and it's going to want to take over and be the overarching final word energy of the whole situation. I am the ism. Right? There has to be a governor. Oh, you suppose that's why there's a seventh adjutant? Yeah, right. See, because the sixth adjutant must be governed. If it's left ungoverned, it takes over and destroys everything, as they're just talking about there. So that philosophic impulse, that seventh adjutant, just the degree to which the seventh adjutant is merely the philosophic impulse is there, right? There's some genuineness of philosophic oversight, like I was just talking about. But the sixth adjutant, I mean, think about how, you know, maybe even yourself, for many years reading the Urantia book, you know, you hadn't really sat down to try to memorize the seven adjutants. And every time you thought about them, you always thought that the seventh adjutant was the spirit of worship.
Right.
You know, or even when you took notice that it was only the sixth, and it's like, well, that doesn't seem right. It should be the seventh.
I used to think it appeared to be
the same. Yeah. See, that's that natural tendency to unleash a meaningless cult, to vitiate religion and supplant philosophy and enslave reason. You've experienced that energy in you. If you thought that should be the seventh adjutant. And like I said, it wants to take over. You need to put a bridle on it. And you need to teach it, you know, the proper gait. That is very important. Okay, but yeah, at the very end there, a genuine cult grows. Just, you know, a little play with the cultivation, right? And the wheat is growing in the field. But the very fact that they say genuine cult, like I said, I mean, as they're about to stress even more here, the main evolutionary stream needs a cult. There just isn't any other way. Okay? And so in that sense, there's a properness, a genuineness to a cult. The sixth adjutant needs an outlet. It needs a healthy outlet. And it just needs a little governor over it so things don't get out of hand. And then, you know, society keeps moving forward until eventually, you know, a much more definitive top-down phenomenon can come into play. But you know, without the sixth adjutant in the beginning, everything, you know, just is devitalized, like they said. It just starts to grind to a halt. Why is Western civilization just grinding to a halt? Right? Because the Christian cult has been devitalized.
Interesting, they use truth twice in that paragraph.
Mm-hmm. Yes. As long as you mentioned that, like he's saying, you know, starts out in the past, truth has grown, and then it says abundant truth, and an adjustable cult. And you're going, well, wait a minute. I mean, no one even knows what truth is. And Pilate said, quid est veritas. And what are they talking about there? It sounds like Like, I should be able to look up the definition of the word truth in the dictionary. No problem. In the past, right? Yeah, well, super consciousness, like I was saying. Right? If you've got a genuine shadow that you're holding on to, super consciously, right, things kind of don't get too messed up in the upper domain. And there's a truth predicate, even though no one's conscious of it, right? Because, you know, especially, I mean, yeah, how much more post-Pentecost is there likely to be a truth predicate in the upper domain, right? Now that you have the spirit of truth engaging the upper domain, right? So if it hasn't been polluted, there's some truth there. It's not going to be in the definition is not going to be in the dictionary, but there's some truth there. Okay. But again, you know, the corruption, you know, a meaningless cult vitiates, you know, religion, and that's that pollution that we talk about so much, where you take the proper cosmic state that's put up there by grace, and you start dragging up scientific dictation, social usage, and religious dogma to supplant what's sitting on the three seats in the temple. And obviously, you know, the seat on the sixth level will get corrupted, if not completely perverted, you know, turned around 180 degrees. Yeah, if that corruption is extreme. Okay, so that's but again, just, you know, as we read forward here, remember that they wanted to highlight how important the cult is to the main evolutionary stream. Okay.
Regardless of the drawbacks and handicaps, every new revelation of truth has given rise to a new cult, and even the restatement of the religion of Jesus must develop a new and appropriate symbolism. Modern man must find some adequate symbolism for his new and expanding ideas, ideals, and loyalties. This enhanced symbol must arise out of religious living, spiritual experience. And this higher symbolism of a higher civilization must be predicated on the concept of the fatherhood of God and be pregnant with the mighty ideal of the brotherhood of man.
Okay. All right, see, now it starts. Yeah, I think everyone remembers there's some soaring statements here in this final section. Okay, so see, again, regardless of the drawbacks and handicaps, the main evolutionary stream must have a cult or it's devitalized. And every new revelation of truth, see, in a sense, needs to be downstepped and shadowified a little bit, you know, for the main evolutionary stream. When Melchizedek did the other non-dispensational revelation, you know, he had two modes, right? This whole bit about every new revelation of truth has given rise to a new cult, right? The overt cult that Machiavelli and Melchizedek fostered the establishment of, you know, that got written in history, is with Abraham, right? We had a whole new cult founded upon Abraham, you know, and to a degree, the outer framework of that cult, you know, not only encompasses Judaism, but Islam and Christianity. Right? The Abrahamic cult. There was another cult that he generated that didn't get writ large in history, wasn't so overt. It was, you know, a little bit more of a kind of a secret society, that parallel stream that he fostered with the Kenites. Okay. What he was doing doesn't establish that parallel stream with a group of individuals as definitively courageous and independent as what the fifth epical revelation sort of forces. So it was almost a little bit more of kind of an alternative evolutionary stream that he started there. But nonetheless, it's basically, you know, he has a certain out of sight stream that he fostered, you know, that occasionally put forward a leader like Moses to help the main evolutionary stream. You know, obviously, see, there must have been some vital phenomenon there, some, you know, vitalized phenomenon, some, you know, basic cult, or it couldn't be ongoing for centuries and, you know, spit out of Moses or something occasionally, right? And then, see, they remind you of how it basically, if it's not obvious, how it works with the fifth epical revelation. Right? There, you know, so much, you know, when I'm talking about the fifth epical revelation, I'm talking about that parallel stream of the rugged individuals, because that's where I see my ministry. I wasn't born to minister to the main evolutionary stream. Okay? But the main evolutionary stream does need to be ministered to. It needs to be revitalized desperately, you know, or, you know, say hello to the interregnum. Okay? They tell you point blank, you know, where is that? You know, this revelation of truth, what does it contain that can provide an upstepping to the main evolutionary stream? Well, it's part four. Right? And that's what, you know, a lot of what part
say it right there, right?
Yeah, they just say it point blank, right? Right? That's what, you know, a lot of what the restatement of the religion of Jesus is about there is, you know, for the benefit of the eventual revitalizing of the main evolutionary stream of at least the Western world. You know, you can hope that it could bring some vitalization into other parts of the world, or hasn't yet, like India or something. You know, we all know some of the things they say about this stuff in the book, but see, you know, just see, there's two different modes here, just like there was two different modes with Machiavelli and Melchizedek. And everyone has to kind of figure out where they kind of, what ministry they were born into, if they were born into a ministry. Is it to foster those courageous and independent cosmic thinkers? Or is it to, you know, take what's here and produce a cult? You know, specifically what's in part four. And produce a genuine cult that, like I said, at least Western civilization desperately needs, or it's going to die. It's a very different modes of ministry. I mean, the way Machiavelli and Melchizedek engaged Abraham was very different than his private talks with, you know, the select little crew, you know, where he's talking about all sorts of transcendent things that, you know, if he even attempted to talk to Abraham about, Abraham, just his eyes would have glazed over instantly. Right? Abraham knew, ooh, you know, kill the infidels. He could wrap his mind around that. You know, a few simple concepts, okay? But, you know, abstract, you know, discussions about the genuine Trinity or something, yeah, no, I mean, it's completely beyond him. Right? He needed a revitalized ghost cult, you know, exalted ghost cult notion, you know, kind of get the Most High thing going again, and et cetera. You know, kind of just revitalizing the Adam and Eve Most High injection, you know. Okay, so.
Extension.
Yeah, all that. Okay, so anyway, you know, just, you know, looking. See, modern man must find, like I said, right, you know, the reason it's must is because otherwise, say hello to the interregnum. That's the must there. Must find some adequate symbolism for this new and expanding, for his new and expanding, and see, it's not just ideals, ideas, ideals, and loyalties. And why do they bring in the loyalties? You know, because remember, the whole foundation of your spiritual nature is the third adjutant, the energy of loyalty. I mean, what happens to the functioning of your sixth adjutant, if you're a patriotic American, when the flag is raised? Do you feel the energy of the third adjutant burn within you, the loyalty that that symbol reminds you of? You know, and will you say, you know, I'll die for this, the ongoingness of this endeavor, right? Very important. I mean, there's that literal symbol, the flag. You know, why does every country have a flag? And again, it's the cult. It's the symbolism. Yep, you got something?
In Jerusalem, they had,
yeah.
Yeah.
They had a material emblem.
Sure. Yeah.
Along that line, I was thinking of symbols and how I can't quite figure out. But the Paradise Trinity symbol, the concentric circles, well, it's always been one of my favorites. That, I think, will be a symbol for what you're talking about, the parallel stream.
Yeah, but of course, even in that, to get out of the old wineskin and not think of that as a symbol, the three concentric circles, being a symbol for the first triunity, for the association of the three infinite persons.
Well, I said the parallel.
I know you did, right? But you know, the old wineskin, when it's, you know, when you read Paradise Trinity in the book, you think the association of the three persons. No, that's not the Paradise Trinity. Paradise Trinity is a fourth fact.
Besides, somebody else owns a trademark.
Right? And just, you know, just how difficult it is to not just let your simple counting, quantity like material mind look at that symbol and think 1, 2, 3.
Well, you're preaching to the choir.
I know I am. I know I'm preaching to the choir right now. But you know, this is being recorded and it's being listened to, you know, it'll be listened to for a long time. Right? This is a difficult phenomenon. You know, to actually make that step. You know, that it's qualities of that fourth fact that are being represented in that symbol, and not the three infinite persons.
Which is a good reason for it to be an ongoing symbol that will become well known, I think.
You know, it's remember, you know, see, and most importantly, see, it can be a remind. It should be a reminder that there's the whole. You know, and part of that symbol is that. It's like, well, okay, so there's the whole. I'd like to know, why is it that those three infinite parts, the three infinite persons, why do they have a place in the whole? Well, because it reminds you that there's three phases, if you will, or functionings of the Paradise Trinity that sort of give a place for those three parts within that whole or under that umbrella. Right.
And everything is in cooperative subordination.
Yeah.
So it's a willful subordination on the part of everyone.
Yeah. Right, but just remember, there's a reason why we start out every Friday night with this distinction is vital. Oh, we were just talking about devitalized and, right? This distinction is vital. Right? That, you know, to the fifth epical revelation wants to definitively put forward this recognition for the first time of the whole. You know, and to begin to see the parts anew, to begin to really see the parts for the first time, divorced of all the magic that we've had to add to the parts because they haven't existed in the context of a whole before. Right? Non-magical, better ideas of the Universal Father are only possible if there's a context within the Universal Father exists. Otherwise, he's got to be a magical part. Right? And that, like I bring up all the time, I mean, that's a difficult step for someone coming out of a very definitive monotheistic cult, right? To, what do you mean there's something above God? Yeah, not only is there something above God, there's an infinite amount of stuff infinitely above God. The biggest, most infinite thing infinitely above God is something called the Trinity Infinite. The infinity of the Universal Father is negligible in comparison to the infinity of the Trinity Infinite. And that can...
If infinity is measured.
Right? So, yeah, those can be very upsetting, disturbing, discombobulating. Because, the revelation is forcing a very different philosophic framework above for the parts to become new within. You know, and the parts will never become new until that philosophic framework, is revolutionized, really. And like they're pointing out here, guess what? Most people have lost that philosophic framework. So you've got to reawaken a philosophic framework before you can improve it. And there are more and more. There's meaningless cults that are being generated. Secular cults that are all the more trying to supplant what residual philosophic oversight there is. Yeah. Anyway, you got something?
Yeah. Well, Terry, you remember, like, the symbol of my generation growing up, it was very simple. It was a peace sign. It was very simple. And it also had a six, insignia as well going along with it. But, and that sort of grew up out of, on its own. I mean, it was sort of like happened. It happened quickly. Mm-hmm. And it was everywhere. You still see it around today, but I mean, I'm just saying that's an example of something that kind of, it wasn't really planned or anything, or it just kind of took off, but it represented something in people that everybody could feel good about. Everybody's just sort of got involved with. You know, these particular paragraphs right here really are really challenging, I think, to, as you say, as what Chris said a minute ago, to those who are trying to appeal to the masses versus just to the appeal, to the congregation versus, just to the leaders of the congregation, so to speak. And to me, this is one of the challenges that, us as your answer book readers need to take up and take a look at pretty carefully, because as he said, time's a wasting. I mean, we can see more and more we're not headed in the right direction. I'm not saying we're headed in the wrong direction necessarily, fully yet, but you definitely see signs. I mean, I think there's always hope.
Mm-hmm. And just one little thought, going back to the second paragraph in the section, what you said there about how it no one seemed to sort of invent it. It just, this symbolism just kind of came out of nowhere. Remember what they said there? The more this ritual has been an unconscious growth, the stronger it has gripped its devotees. Mm-hmm. Right. See, again, because the mystery of that, so that the fact that we naturally do this, the sixth adjutant is functioning, and all the other adjutants are as well. And okay, stuff just gets generated, and no one has to be very conscious of it. And the interesting thing in the early days, the more it just seems to come out of nowhere, and no one has any consciousness of its origin. The more powerful it is, the more helpful it is to primitive man being vitalized and moved forward by it. It's like we talk about so much, there's this vast conspiracy that is set up with us, that we respond very, very helpfully to all sorts of things that in some very objective sense, you know, are false or silly or illogical or whatnot. But they have their day, you know, in the evolutionary process. They have their place. But again, I'll remind you, even though the evolutionary stream, because of, you know, especially because of rebellion default, it's still in a very primitive state. It very much still needs all of this sort of stuff, the emotion and everything. You know, if you really want to stake your claim, you know, in that parallel stream, it's a very, very different place to attempt to live. You know, and to find vitality in, to find a belonging in. You will, you know, you, as we were saying, you still need belonging. But see, you know, you will find that belongingness in your inner life as a cosmic citizen, not in your outer life. Yeah. As a member of some party or something, right? Okay, let's see. Back to some of the details in this paragraph here, though. Okay, so they've got this little bit about modern man must find some adequate symbolism, right? And we've got the ideas, and we've got the ideals, we've got loyalties. Notice that they are pointing out that they're, you know, if you're going to produce this new cult based upon the life and teachings of Jesus in part four, you need to get back to that core thing that even Jesus himself was trying to do 2,000 years ago, right? And get genuine spiritual experience, not stuff that's called spiritual experience, but genuine spiritual experience as a predicate. Like they see, it must arise out of religious living, spiritual experience. Right? So, you know, it's not just, you know, what did Jesus do on a particular Tuesday, you know, in part four, right? I mean, obviously the nucleus is what he was trying to do 2,000 years ago, to get people to actually have an eternity predicate, a spiritual predicate, instead of a material, temporal predicate to their doings of their life. Okay. Not easy to achieve.
It's especially difficult today because even the words have been corrupted.
Yeah.
The word brotherhood is, well... Yeah.
You'll have to apologize for using it now.
That's sexist.
You know, you'll get an F on your essay in college if you use the word mankind. Don't get me started on that. But the other thing, okay, so besides, okay, there has to be a genuine spirit predicate here to it. But what else do they say here? And this higher symbolism of a higher civilization must be predicated on the concept of the fatherhood of God. Do you see something curious there? Look at those words in the book.
Must be predicated on the consciousness. The fatherhood of God, is what you said.
It's a little technical issue in those words.
Capitalized.
Why, yeah. Why is fatherhood capitalized? Okay.
So because it's not mother.
You'll notice something if you look closely in the Urantia book. Okay. In general, okay, except for I think two exceptions, which have specific issues to them. When they talk about quote unquote the fatherhood of God in part four, okay, definitely every time they talk about the fatherhood of God in part four, it's lowercase f. The only place you have capital F, Fatherhood of God, the first three parts. And like I said, if I remember correctly, a couple times they do lowercase, but it's special circumstances.
That's not on the chopping block, is it?
Yeah, think about if someone noticed that and decided they should harmonize the book and change them all to, most of them are lowercase, so I think they should change them all to lowercase. It's capitalized because they're trying to remind you of a little bit of a fifth epical revelation edition, in contrast to the fourth epical revelation. A little fifth epical revelation addition to the concept of the Father of God. Deity. Capital F deity, the capital F Father, that facet of deity. Remember we saw this at the end of the preceding section when they talked about that we still evince a disposition to bargain with capital D deity rather than bargain with God. Mm-hmm. Well, on the one hand, with the deity there, bargaining with deity, okay, on the one hand, you can say, well, not everyone on the planet has a personal God concept as a religionist, and so maybe it's a little more correct and generalized to say they're bargaining with deity, like a Buddhist bargaining with deity rather than bargaining with God. Okay, yeah, there's that. But remember, one of the main things that the fifth epical revelation is trying to introduce is that which is transcendent of God, deity. And to even think of God, the fact of God itself, anew, to define it as personalized deity. So that, in the beginning there's deity, and then eventually some of it got personalized, and then there was God. As opposed to in the beginning was God, and he made stuff. Okay? Kind of the old story. If you can take this sort of lowercase f, the concept of the Father and of God, which, might even kind of just be sort of metaphoric, fatherhood of God, to get it a little bit more definitive, okay, and capitalize the F and remind yourself that of the deity issue in play, the fact of deity in play.
So it is capitalized in that quote you do in the end. It's the Father idea.
Yeah, right. See, and again, that, remember, I point that out. That's the other thing about part four in the book.
That's interesting.
Okay, for the main evolutionary stream, right, it doesn't have any place, really. But for the fifth epical revelation student, it really is, not just going to use part four to make the cult for the evolutionary stream, but is the rest of the fifth epical revelation for the parallel stream. A lot of the stuff in there is really kind of not for that cult. Like the levels of meaning and stuff like that. That's not for the cult. That's for the parallel stream. That's why I talk about it all the time, right? Because I'm ministering to the rugged individuals in the parallel stream.
So you can't just take the fourth part and put it out there in mainstream Christianity because there's too much.
You can't just dump it out there and it's a magic bunch of words that produce a cult. No.
You said it's not for the parallel stream. Did you mean the mainstream? You said it's not for it.
No, if I said it was not for the parallel, I meant it was for the parallel stream. I just said it backwards. If I said it that way, yeah. Just that little aside. Every time that in part four when it says the Father, initially in your old wineskin, you're thinking, oh well, they're just they don't want to say the universal Father. It's like no, it's not like the midwayers are writing apart from the first three parts of the book. in the fullest sense of interpreting what's in part four there, if it just says the Father, they want you to think about that facet of deity, not the individual. Right? They don't want you to base your foundation of interpretation of that sentence on the reality perspective. They don't want you to interpret from the individuality viewpoint. They want you to interpret it from the unity viewpoint, in the deity perspective, first. and then bring it into the reality perspective. You know, so just think about how difficult that is to explain. It's like, well, this sentence is not predicated on reality, you tell the person. It's predicated on deity. Okay, the uninitiated says, oh, so it's predicated on the imagination. No. Right. I mean, there's so much about the book that is difficult for people to even relate to. You know, something separate from quote-unquote reality. So, I mean, that's how ensconced we are in the individuality, you know, in looking at things from the individuality viewpoint. So we think that reality is everything. No, it's half of everything, if you will, you know, conceptually. So that's what's going on here. I mean, in general, the first three parts of the book, it's capital F, Fatherhood of God. In contrast to lowercase f, Fatherhood of God in part 4. To remind you how you can upstep that, you know, and think about it more literally, you know, not just, well, figuratively, there's the Fatherhood of God. It's like, no, literally, there's a capital F, Fatherhood of God. That facet of deity called the Father, one of the things that facet of deity does is it functions, is it initiates.
But it's called the universal Father as a facet.
No, that's one of the facets.
So which one, what are you saying? The Father?
The Father is all six facets, you know, together. The first center, the first source, the universal Father, the universal creator, the universal controller, the infinite upholder. Right? The fullness of the Father.
So we haven't portrayed that Father.
No.
Yeah. Sorry, I guess we won't.
That concept of the Father, and the functioning of that deity, not the actions of a person, not the actions of the person called the universal Father.
You can call the circuit the Father. So but, we should put a label on it.
Terry keeps doing asides here because of total deity stuff. But
I am trying to understand that, though. I do.
But see that. But they're trying to get it. You know, see, there's a way to not just think about that, quote unquote, the Fatherhood of God. It's like, well, he isn't literally my father. Okay, no. But to think about it a little more literally, for instance, you know, in the fullness of that, if you want to understand what the personality is that comes from the Father, it's a measure of a very rarefied deity stuff. So rarefied that in the normal sense of stuff, you shouldn't call it stuff. Like matter, mind, and spirit stuff. Okay? You shouldn't even think of it as an object. It's that transcendent of a rarefied quote-unquote stuff of a particular flavor of deity. Of the Father. See, the literalness, the directness by bringing in the concept of capital D, deity, apart from God, of understanding the Fatherhood of God. Okay? So that's, it's just important to pause and stress that, you know, and just search and notice, like, why is it all basically all capitals in parts 1, 2, and 3 and not in part 4?
So would you say there's a difference between the restatement of the religion of Jesus and the restatement of the life and teachings of Jesus?
Of course. Yeah, I mean, because again, remember, you know, the fundamental thing that you take away from part 4, it's told what the final paper is. You know, when all is said and done with part 4, there's the final paper, right? Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. Remember what the title of the fourth epical revelation is. It's not the teachings of Jesus or the life and teachings of Jesus. The title of the fourth epical revelation is Jesus of Nazareth. Right? You have the Dalmatia teachings for the first, the Edenic teachings for the second. Okay. The third is Melchizedek of Salem. Fourth is Jesus of Nazareth. Fifth is the Urantia Papers. It's Jesus of Nazareth is the revelation. Right? His faith. Right? That the foundation of his religion, right? The statement of the religion of Jesus.
That which we know.
Not a new Jesusism, not a new religion about Jesus, predicated on part four. You know, that's even more self-satisfied than Christianity, you know, has been for the last 2,000 years, in pushing all the other religions aside as the only true religion, blah, blah, blah. Okay? It's like, well, this is definitely the only true religion. I mean, we know what he did on Tuesday, April, you know, whatever. right.
Only John Mark got to see
that. Right. Part four awakens the same faith, the same genuine faith in you, the potential leader of this new cult that the, you know, that the main evolutionary stream needs, right? That faith of Jesus is awakened in you. Not a belief in Jesus. That isn't what the faith of Jesus means, right? But literally, the same genuine faith was in Jesus' upper domain. He knew the definition of faith. Okay. Those that are going to found that new cult need to also know that, which means they've got a lot of work to do to get out of the old wineskins, okay? Because if they're using the dictionary to figure out what the title of paper 196 means, the faith of Jesus, okay, they got problems, okay? The first three parts of the book are very important to not get you so immediately in the old wineskins when you read part four. Yeah. Yeah. But eventually, when you're going to found that new cult, you put this book down, right? You even put some book that just has part four in it down, okay? You're not going to found the religion with this book for the main evolutionary stream. I mean, the book in its literal state in your lap, with all of its words, is really for the parallel stream. Okay, the cult that the main evolutionary stream needs is a cult predicated on the faith of Jesus, right? The religion of Jesus, not the book. You know, and I'll remind you again, it's like it says, well, every new revelation of truth has given rise to a new cult, so how can you do it without the book? Again, are the words in the book the revelation of truth? No. Truth can't be defined with words. There's a sphere of truth in a mind that has genuine faith up there as a nucleus. That sphere of truth, that revelation of truth, goes out with those individuals and manifests fruits in the founding of that new cult. Just like they were saying about using truth twice in that paragraph we just read, that truth. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, this section has all kinds of stuff to think about and points out a number of ways that you can get off on an improper start with the book, you know.
Is that why they say perforce you must live with the religion of Jesus?
Yeah.
Pretty much, it's really, yeah. not just read about.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm
yeah.
sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead. It's just, I expected that we would talk about this quite a bit because it's very important stuff for a lot of people who have been thinking about this, what this book is here for and what you're supposed to do with it for decades.
Finding it in the
cults. All right, let's keep going here.
The old cults were too egocentric. The new must be the outgrowth of applied love. The new cult must, like the old, foster sentiment, satisfy emotion, and promote loyalty. But it must do more. It must facilitate spiritual progress, enhance cosmic meanings, augment moral values, encourage social development, and stimulate a high type of personal religious living. The new cult must provide supreme goals of living, which are both temporal and eternal, social and spiritual.
See it?
No pressure.
Yeah, well, that's straightforward. I can easily envision that new cult. But start at the end there. I've already stressed this. Temporal and eternal, you know, and then parenthetically, social and spiritual. Right, to stress that, right? Social is temporal. Spiritual is eternal. Okay? If you're using the word spiritual, you know, just pause and say, wait a minute, am I applying this word, am I using this word to something that's temporal? Then I'm not properly applying the word.
Spiritual, not religious,
means temporal. Yeah, I mean, you know, even the, right, for most people, even if they say spiritual but not religious, you know, because they think religious is too temporal, quote unquote, it's too much about the affairs of the world and institutions and blah blah blah. Yeah, well, what's your definition of spiritual? You know, Mr. or Mrs. Spiritual but not religious. Right, isn't what you call spiritual just your feelings about temporal affairs and the fact that you're sentimental about temporal affairs? I'm spiritual. See, again, it's not spiritual because it's temporal. Now, and this is what Jesus couldn't make any progress with the apostles on. He couldn't get them to set temporal aside. Right? Everything was temporal. After all, spirit land, ghost land, dream land is a temporal affair, right? Haven't we always known that spirit land was a temporal affair? Right? It's dream land. My dreams are a temporal affair. Right? See, humans have no predicate for thinking like this. It's like, no, nothing to do with temporal affairs, no matter how illusory you make them. What is eternity about? What's spiritual really about? Yeah.
Pretty still and pretty small at first.
Remember, until the Jews were in exile in Babylon, they couldn't find any measure of spiritual, genuine religious. Their concept of religion was purely temporal, social justice. It took that subtle influence from the residual of Andite culture amongst the, you know, relatively speaking, barbarians of the Babylonians, right? But it was enough to get them the first inkling of a genuine religious consciousness in their minds, some sort of an inner life, actually. You know, for the predicate, conscious inner life, for the predicate of their religion. So what else do we have there? Just notice how inescapably limited this cult that needs to be generated for the main evolutionary stream is. I mean, it's going to be struggling with it's your thoughts, not your feelings that lead you Godward, because, right, it has to satisfy emotion. Right? Yeah, you have to be, you have to balance your spiritual idealism with lots of material pragmatism to form the cult for the main evolutionary stream, predicated on part four. Right? It's just the way it is. It's got to, you know, fosters sentiment. It's like, oh boy, here comes sentimentalism, is, you know, what people think religion is, or it's got to satisfy emotion. Oh boy, here comes emotionalism, what people think religion is. Yeah, it's going to be there. You're going to have to put up with people still kind of thinking that's what religion is, sentimentalism or emotionalism or escapism or... because it's a glacial evolutionary process. Right? Paul knew that. Right? Remember, it's Paul's Christianity that was the most effective, appealing, and enduring of any ritual ever conceived or devised. That thing that so often is demonized, right? Pauline Christianity. Right. He, you know, he was very effective, right?
Well, that's remarkable because his the Damascus experience was, you know, almost straight.
Yeah.
You know, straight vertical, and then he temporalized that.
In an
effective way.
Yeah, I mean, and think about how apart from the religion of Jesus, the religion of Paul inescapably was. The religion of Paul was predicated on a dramatic, vivid conversion event. The religion of Jesus has no such event. The religion of Jesus is devoid of any big steps. It's an imperceptible gradually. It grew gradually with no jumps in it. Yeah, like I always point out, why is the preface of the last paper in the book bizarrely long? I mean, what kind of a preface is that long? You know, technically you say no prefaces. But see, you know, the first section, Jesus the Man, is preceded by a very long preface. What is that? That's that long gradually. The faith of Jesus was built up through a long preface of gradually. Right? The paper is constructed to remind you how the religion of Jesus is not the religion of Paul. The religion of Paul has a one-sentence preface. Not a, how many paragraphs are in this preface? Okay. So again, that, you know, just that, how different that is. How much most religionists, because of Paul's influence, are all about conversion and mysticism. Yeah, it's not the religion of Jesus. Jesus wasn't a kindly mystic. Okay. but all of the paintings are kindly mystics. Yeah. Let's see here. Anyway, before we continue on, that list of, wow, it must facilitate spiritual progress, enhance cosmic meanings, augment moral values, encourage social development, and stimulate a high type of personal religious living. Wow. And what's going to do that?
This is kind of backing up, but the last sentence on, in paragraph 3, will be identical unless the rituals are arbitrarily standardized by authority.
Yeah.
What's authority mean there? What are they speaking to?
Well, there's all kinds of cults on the planet. The Roman Catholic Church went all over the world and standardized, you know, as an authority and standardized.
Okay.
It didn't demand the elimination of the prior modalities of the local cult, you know, in South America, say, or something. Okay, the Catholic mode of the Christian cult is very clever. I mean, it's, you know, that cult has been elastic. The symbolism is expansile, right? It assimilated all this stuff. Okay, so you've got a kind of an exalted female notion in your cult. We can bring that right in. We'll just tell you, we'll standardize that. That's Mary. Right? You know? And we'll let you maybe still use the old name you had for your, you know, in your old cult. But everyone knows that that's a local name for Mary. Right? You standardized it. But see, again, they're reminding us. See, it's like, well, boy, they don't have any principles. They just, you know, assimilate everything. And yeah, what do they just say? That's important. You know, and it's philosophers like, you know, like you had in the early centuries of the church that, you know, allowed there to be a domain above, you know, so that cult below could morph.
Resistance is futile.
Right?
Could you comment on the first sentence there?
Where?
On the one that we just read, that Paul just read. The old cuts were too
rough.
The new must be the outgrowth of applied love.
Yeah. I was going to get back to that. Yeah, thank you. No, thanks for reminding me, because I'd forgotten I was going to get back to it. So just applied love. What's the single word?
Mercy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Mercy is applied love.
Mercy.
And of course, we mean love on the sixth level of meaning, and its application on the fifth is mercy. Right. A whole new definition of the word love, and a whole new definition of applied love, of mercy. On the
Son, right, is mercy. Ministry is from the...
Yeah, but of course, you know, again, you don't want, you know, for this, the sake of this cult, you know, you don't want to get into all that, right?
Right.
But yeah, you know, in a way you can begin to think about the first and second persons, right? You know, you have love and then applied love in the Son, in the eternal Son, yes. Right, so, you know, it must be an outgrowth of that. See, the whole point is to manifest genuine fruits of the Spirit, which means you have to have the genuine Spirit to begin with, right? You know, if the fourth epical revelation is about love and service, okay, that's genuine love we're talking about there, right? And the service in the outer life predicated on that genuine love. Not just backed up a little bit into the lower domain and predicated on feeling or sentiment, but backed all the way up on genuine love. You know, not affectionate service merely, right? But loving service. What is loving service? You know, right? I mean, you've got to. It's like, oh well, what is love? If it's not affection, what is it? Yeah. The personal realization of divine fellowship.
Right.
It's totally internal predicate. Right. It's not I'm observing the needy out there and I bring that in as a feeling and then I spit it back out as a feeling full service. No. The it doesn't originate in the outer life and then get, you know, mildly, you know, ingested and, you know, and spit back out again, right? No, it originates in the inner life, genuine loving service. Right? So you got to get to that. Again, the spiritual predicate, like I said, it must arise out of religious living, spiritual experience, right? Not material experience with the needy. Spiritual experience. Okay, what else does this cult need?
No cult can endure and contribute to the progress of social civilization and individual spiritual attainment unless it is based on the biologic, sociologic, and religious significance of the home. A surviving cult must symbolize that which is permanent in the presence of unceasing change. It must glorify that which unifies the stream of ever-changing social metamorphosis. It must recognize true meanings, exalt beautiful relations, and glorify the good values of real nobility.
All right, so the last one again is those genuine spiritual existential predicates, that threefold of that truth, beauty, you know, that threefold of that truth and that goodness, where it's truth, beauty, goodness. Lots of musts. Right? They're trying to teach you the science of cults, right? There's a physics to cults, and if you ignore the physics, it's not going to work. All of those elements there, and then of course the italicized one, just because it's so foundational, like we've seen so many times. I mean, all institutions are predicated on the family and the home, right? So obviously, that has to be revitalized if it's been lost. And of course, in many ways, it's been lost, at least in a lot of sectors of our society. It can't just be a whole bunch of impractical, mystical mumbo jumbo, right? It has to have some solid, practical ideas. And remember ideas, ideals, and loyalties? Okay. So it has to have some practical ideas about the home. And these have to be glorified, where that's just what you do. Right? And you're very religious about the home, you know, as it were, quote unquote. Okay.
What is an idea of the home that could be glorified, in your opinion?
Everyone has 12 kids.
Right, so you go, oh yeah, this once vital cult of where you definitely are going to have kids, and and you're glorified if you have 12 kids, and you don't allow divorce, basically, and you don't allow sex outside of marriage, or all these various mores, right, that were treated as morals by the church in order to establish and maintain the integrity of the home. Okay, and we can say, well, those are silly, arbitrary mores, I'm not going to abide by that anymore. It's like, well, you've got to come up with something definitive, and it has to be basically taboo to do anything else. The cult's not going to endure. It can't just be free love, anything goes. Right? A generation that believes in free love is not going to establish an enduring cult, because it's not predicated on the home. Not going to work. I mean, rank savagery doesn't sound like the predicate for an ongoing human institution. So there's some very practical issues that have to be reminded here. The horde is not going to work here. And again, notice what they stressed, like I told you, the whole point of that cult about that existentialization, even if it's basically false existentialization, a surviving cult must symbolize that which is permanent in the presence of unceasing change. So one of the things that new cult is going to have very definitively that past cults haven't had is the fact that God, the Universal Father, is changeless. Purely existential. No prayer changes him. Not one iota. So it can't be a cult where you have the belief that prayers have all these powers. It's going to have a very different concept of prayer. Prayer's indispensable, okay? But you're going to have to revolutionize what that cult believes about prayer. They can't be in the old ghost cult mode where they think prayer is the magic technique for coercing God. God is not coercible. He's unchangeable. Okay? So that new cult, see, is going to have a very different God and a very different prayer than all cults that have ever existed before. Yeah.
I have no idea.
Right? And it, but it's got to still be powerful, right? I mean, one of the things that makes the old cult so powerful is you feel empowered that, you know, there's certain magic formulas or whatnot, certain deep humilities of prayer that, you know, get God on your side. I mean, so you're going to have to come up with something just as compelling, right? Just as empowering as the idea that prayer magically coerces God. What is it? Good question.
About the moving of self toward God instead of moving God around.
Right. So, yeah, obviously, you know, prayer can't be, you know, an awful lot of previous cults have been kind of prayeristic, right? It's like prayerism. You know, prayer is all you need. Prayerful problem solving. I'm going to pray on it. Right? Yeah, you know that new cult needs to, you know, put forward an idea that worship is not the rituals, the symbolism of the cult. That's not, worship is not a word for the ritualistic symbolism of the cult. Worship is something, has nothing to do with the outer life. It's purely an inner life fact, right? If you can get that in that new cult, right, then prayer can be made anew as the ladder that you climb to get up to that genuine inner life fact of worship. Right? Up through prayer and thanksgiving to worship. Again, I mean, a lot of the kind of the basic elements of the cult are talked about in parts 1, 2, and 3, and it's not all just in part 4. But you know, a cult based upon the architects of the master universe instead of Jesus is a step too far. Okay. Okay. Right. That's what they said. I mean, the cult is going to come from part 4, basically, right? But it's going to, you know, exactly how you rework the cult elements is, you know, what you've learned in the other three parts of the book.
But for the parallel stream, I need the architects of the
Right.
That excites me.
Yes.
Yeah.
For those who want more than just a new cult to belong to, you really don't need any cult to belong to. I mean, yeah, the architects of being and the architects of the master universe and the qualified vicegerents of the ultimate and there's all kinds of cool stuff, right?
But that's kind of cult-like. The cult of
yeah.
Deity cult.
Yeah. See, obviously the degree to which that parallel stream has a cult, it's Yeah, it's based upon capital F fatherhood of God, more directly, right? It has courses called Total Deity Seminar.
Right, we are.
See, and things like that. See, okay, let's keep going here.
But the great difficulty of finding a new and satisfying symbolism is because modern men, as a group, adhere to the scientific attitude, eschew superstition, and abhor ignorance, while as individuals they all crave mystery and venerate the unknown. No cult can survive unless it embodies some masterful mystery and conceals some worthful unattainable. Again, the new symbolism must not only be significant for the group, but also meaningful to the individual. The forms of any serviceable symbolism must be those which the individual can carry out on his own initiative, and which he can also enjoy with his fellows. If the new cult could only be dynamic instead of static, it might really contribute something worthwhile to the progress of mankind, both temporal and spiritual.
And again, a lot more of the, you know, really helpful statements about the physics of a cult there. Notice that, you know, the forms of any serviceable symbolism must be those which the individual can carry out on his own initiative, right? And which he can also enjoy with his fellows. You know, that is straightforward. I mean, remember what they said, you know, that an awful lot of what powers the cult isn't like what's in that parallel stream with reality or reasonableness, right? But rather in its vividness and the universality of its ready and simple application. See, we're just getting a little bit more on that ready and simple application. That's very important. You know, it can't be only production number, Hollywood production numbers, okay, with a cast of thousands, right, and a widescreen lens. Okay, it's got to be something that the individual can do, because, of course, this cult, more than other previous cults, has to, you know, be bringing in the individual more, so that it's more genuinely spiritual instead of social. Right? It's not just something. It's not just a group activity.
It's not a new app. Huh?
Because genuine religion is personal spiritual experience, which means it's absolutely unique and apart from everyone else's spiritual experience. It's in purely in the inner life.
It's an app if you can download it.
Yeah. Okay, so there's that. Let's see what else you have here. The notice at the beginning there that we've talked about this. Okay, as a group, they say, right? You know, modern men adhere to the scientific attitude, eschew superstition, and abhor ignorance. While, as individuals, they all crave mystery and venerate the unknown. Right? Because again, that's natural to crave mystery and venerate the unknown. And so, like you've heard me say many times, you know, on the one hand, you have a society that still is in the wake of the Enlightenment, and so, you know, there's still a fair amount of abhorring ignorance, for instance. But it's slipping, right? I mean, because the institutions, you know, don't abhor ignorance like they used to. So that's slipping. But the individual is still naturally the way individuals are. And, I mean, there is a very strong cult-generating tendency in every individual, even during the Enlightenment, let alone in the wake of the Enlightenment, that delights in the exaltation of ignorance. I mean, it's one of the classic lines that Paul puts forward in establishing Pauline Christianity. You know, the thing that's really cool about our religion is that it's predicated on the exaltation of ignorance, and then the logical Greeks think it's foolishness. See, he held that up as, and of course he knew what he was doing, right? Yeah, because he knew our nature. We crave mystery and venerate the unknown, right? And, you know, the exaltation of ignorance. The Lord works in mysterious ways, or whatever, right? So, you get philosophers starting to talk about the unknowable, and religionists go, yes, that's God. The philosophers have discovered God. He's the unknowable. No, think about that for a second. What good is a God in a religion if that God is unknowable? Where's God knowingness then on the sixth level of meaning if God is unknowable? It's illogical, right? but you know, notice how common it is. Yeah, because the cult supplants philosophy. You shove that logical oversight down under your foot, you know, and you go, well, we know it's powerful, and there's a point to that. It is kind of powerful, just because it's illogical. Oh, it's so mysterious. I mean, it's real even though it's illogical. Oh, it's so mysterious. Okay. Right? That's the individual natural mode that a cult founder plays off of. So this new cult has got to temper that some. I can't buy into that as much as normally, you know, cults have allowed people to buy into that, allowed individuals to buy into that. Let's see. Anything else there? Let's see. Oh, yeah, and again, just reminding you, it's got to be dynamic. And, you know, it needs to do an even better job of tempering the over-existentialization of things, right, so that it's dynamic instead of static. All right, let's get to the last little bit here.
But a cult, a symbolism of rituals, slogans, or goals, will not function if it is too complex. And there must be the demand for devotion, the response of loyalty. Every effective religion unerringly develops a worthy symbolism, and its devotees would do well to prevent the crystallization of such a ritual into cramping, deforming, and stifling stereotype ceremonials, which can only handicap and retard all social, moral, and spiritual progress. No cult can survive if it retards moral growth and fails to foster spiritual progress. The cult is the skeletal structure around which grows the living and dynamic body of personal spiritual experience, true religion, presented by a brilliant evening star of Nebadon.
So just, you notice at the beginning there, the cult, and, you know, they even kind of expanded out, you know, symbolism of ritual, slogans, or goals. You know, that cult will not function if it is too complex. So just restating that, you know, in more direct fashion, that bit about how it has to have a universality if it's ready and simple application.
Yeah, kind of like
we did. Can't be too complicated. You know, and obviously, right, the entire Rancho book is way too complicated. I mean, even part four is way too complicated, you know, in all of its specific glory. It's just too complicated, too much.
Even for 500 years from now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, way down the road, of course, you know, we can handle more complicated things. It's, I mean, you know, notice it didn't say it can't be complex. It is too complex. It's a relative thing, right? I mean, you know, the more sophisticated the individual is, the more complex it can be. Right? But, and then that last little bit is very important. And this is something that I've brought out, you know, as we've been going through part four, the Symmetry of Soul broadcast. The cult is the skeletal structure around which grows the living and dynamic body of personal spiritual experience, true religion. There is such a tendency to think that, you know, one of these limited cult frameworks cuts you off from true religion. And that's not the case. Notice that when they say the cult is a skeletal structure, it's like, well, my skeleton is pretty static. Yeah, okay, there has to be, see, some degree, like I said, of it existentialization, right? That which is constant in the presence of change, right? That, you know, there has to be that there. But the living part, you see, grows around that. You know, one of the things that they make a point of emphasizing about the religion of Jesus is that that true religion developed completely within the very limited, rigid context of the synagogue worship service of 2,000 years ago, with rote prayers, you know, and reading passages from the old, what we call the Old Testament.
640 rules, laws.
Right? I mean, as a matter of fact, you know, that's one of the interesting things when you're going through the Jesus papers there, and you're going, wow, he's gonna give some great talk here. But they don't tell me what he said. All they tell me is the boilerplate of the worship service. What? Why do I care about the boilerplate of the worship service in full regalia, giving me the whole quotes out of the Old Testament stuff? I want to hear what, they don't even tell me what Jesus said. Right? Because the whole point is, see, that's, you know, and they make a point that he grew up with exactly that worship service. And your Luciferian bias, that seems to be stifling. I need to revolt against that. No. That's right. That's the skeletal structure around which grows the living and dynamic body of personal spiritual experience. If you don't have that skeletal structure, you can't grow a living thing. Okay. So it's again how he got to where he did. It wasn't by revolting and setting himself out of that seemingly stifling, stereotyped context. Right? It's only stereotyped if you're not really a living human to begin with. Right? If you're just a helpless victim of the environment, okay, yeah, then it's limiting. But a real human is not a helpless victim of the environment. You take the environment as you find it, and you build a living relationship to the cosmos around that. You work with it. So that's a key point that you can appreciate all the more when you get into part four and really look more, you know, precisely, specifically at how Jesus came to be the Jesus of the public ministry days. Right. You know, and it wasn't through revolutionary rejection of the established church. Right. He did it completely within the established church. Okay. Well, we went that far over 2 hours, and we only read one section. But it's a very important section because it's so much about this question of what am I supposed to do with this book? And, you know, if what you want to do with it is really engage, you know, people at large on the planet, you know, this is reminding you, okay, that is a very challenging thing. There's going to need to be some really clever individuals that can construct a cult, you know, predicated enough on the truths of the revelation to make it living, but simple enough to meet the people as they are out there. There's an awful lot of people that still are plenty satisfied with the Christian cult as it is. So, right, they're not looking for now. So there's Supernafim and Sakonafim and Omniafim and they're not looking for that. But they would delight if a cult could be constructed that didn't seem to be assailed by the science of the Enlightenment. Yeah. One that wasn't devitalized by the recognition of some basic facts. Yeah, and the easiest way to do that, like they were just stressing here, is, well, if it's getting in trouble with the scientists, your religion must not really be a religion. It must be about matter, not spirit. If it was genuinely about spirit, they can play with matter all they want. It doesn't impact you. But if when they play with matter, it impacts you, that's telling you something. You haven't gotten yourself away from matter yet. You haven't actually found genuine religion. Okay, so next time, I thought we might get to it, but we ended up just doing that section. Next time, we'll get into this additional element, you know, kind of back to the story at hand, and precisely how the issue of fetishes, augments our understanding about the evolution of religion. You know, looking at that a little bit more in detail, as opposed to just kind of generally, well, you worship hills or you worship stones or that sort of stuff, but looking a little bit more specifically at the fetish issue. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.